Welcome to the Explore Words, Discover Worlds podcast, presented by Bradford Literature Festival. Join journalist Nabila Ramdani as she discusses her new book, Fixing France, How to Repair a Broken Republic. Through the lens of her Algerian heritage perspective, she charts the course of France's Fifth Republic, formed in the wake of the 1958 Algerian War of Independence. Recorded live at the 2024 Bradford Literature Festival, Ramdani tackles complex themes such as politics, economics, societal shift, and feminism in the future trajectory of the French Republic.
Hello everyone, thank you so much for being here this morning. My name is Mehreen and I'm a journalist. And as a journalist, I'm delighted that the News Agenda has been so friendly to this session, because anyone who's been watching the news will realise there's a super important second round electoral vote happening in France. In around 24 hours time, people will be able to start voting in across the country. And given the prescience of that event and today's session, I'm also delighted to be here with Nabila Ramdani. Nabila is a journalist, a commentator, and an author, most recently of this book, Fixing France. She's also be outside at the end of the session if you want to buy a copy of this brilliant book. Nabila's also going to be signing them. Nabila, you wrote this book before a lot of the upheaval that we've seen in French politics, most recently this month, but also over the last year with various things like immigration bills and emergency decrees happening in France. So why don't you lay out for us why you wrote the book, what motivated it, and some of the really important themes. Then we will have a conversation, and I'm really keen to get questions from the audience. No question, as I'm a journalist, I will tell you no question is silly or stupid. So please put your hand up and there'll be a roving mic and we can hopefully get into a really good dialogue. So Nabila, I will give you the floor. So tell us about the book, introduce it.
Well, thank you very much, Mehreen, for the introduction, and thank you, everyone, for coming this morning. I'm particularly delighted to have you alongside me today. As a leading journalist and a broadcaster yourself, you've often covered the same topics that I write about, and you've been extremely kind in reading my book and reviewing it before it actually was published, so you couldn't be more perfectly positioned to guide our discussion today. And I'm absolutely delighted to be here and speak about my book at the Bradford Literary Festival. And I certainly think that we've picked a good time to discuss why France needs fixing. You know, they say the general election here in Britain was the most divisive for years, but I can assure you that it's a very restrained one compared to the abject chaos that's broken out across the channel. And while the British election led to a Labour landslide, one that has actually been a relatively regular feature since 1945, and of course led to the election of a Labour government, France could be on the way to electing its first far-right government since the Second World War, when the country was occupied by the Nazis and indeed collaborated with them. I was in Paris 2 weeks ago reporting on a massive march attended by some 75,000 people opposing the electoral success of the national rally of Marine Le Pen and Jordan Bardella at the European parliamentary election. Now, both are styling themselves as president and prime minister in waiting, which is pretty incredible considering the party's very disturbing antecedents. And what was particularly interesting about the march was that there were so many people calling for an end to the Fifth Republic itself. And I have to say that this is very common at all political demonstrations now, whether organized by the far right or indeed by the far left or anyone in between. That is to say that the people are blaming the current structure of the Fifth Republic itself for what is going wrong. And that is certainly the thesis of my book. Now, France is a country that seems to have it all, yet its citizens are angry and dissatisfied. Why? I mean, in the past year alone, I've witnessed intense rioting there, interviewed some of the most bigoted extremists you're likely to find anywhere in Europe, and heard thousands of people calling for the destruction of the entire constitutional system that currently holds France together. The world is changing rapidly. France isn't really changing with it. And extreme dissent in a country already known for very extreme dissent is the result. France is in turmoil, and my book highlights failures that are both inherited and new, while also trying to solve them. And this is the main reason I was determined to write this book now, because these extremely dramatic developments are what my book is all about. And I've divided my book into a number of straightforward themes. There are 10 themes explored in 10 chapters, including economic injustice and segregated suburbs, the state of French feminism and the debasement of women, education, identity, terrorism, institutionalized rioting and paramilitary policing, deep-seated racial and religious discrimination, and the rise of the far right, as exemplified by Marine Le Pen and her dynastic party. Now, the big difference between Fixing France and other books on France on the market is that I'm by no means a traditional writer from France. On the contrary, my background is in Algeria, which was once France's most prestigious colony, the absolute jewel in the crown of the French Empire. But unlike similar imperial jewels, such as British India, Algeria was considered to be part of mainland France. It had its own MPs, it had its own town halls, and more than 1 million so-called pieds noirs settlers from Europe. Algeria won its independence from France in 1962, following a horrendously destructive eight-year war that took place both in North Africa and, indeed, on mainland France. The conflict directly led to the creation of the Fifth Republic as an all-powerful president, an alpha male, it has always been a male so far, and an equally strong security state were set up to deal with insurgent Algerian nationalists. And tensions between France and its Algerians continue to this day, not least of all on the estates where many from Algerian backgrounds remain dumped. Algerians were treated with great suspicion then, just as they are today. And the legacy of this cataclysmic conflict still has an enormous influence on modern France. There is a lot of commentary in my book, and indeed an attempt to provide a new and original view of what the modern French Republic is all about. And the book doesn't shy away from very difficult issues, I think it's important, while also acknowledging how massively popular France is for very good reasons. So in this sense, Fixing France is as much a guide to modern France as it is a constructive critique. And that's why I quote the great American Francophile writer James Baldwin in the introduction to my book. And he said, "I love America more than any country in this world. And exactly for this reason, I insist on the right to criticize her perpetually." And this sums up my approach to France. Now, a very important argument in my book is that France, and I use the phrase in my book, is overwhelmed by idealism, because it is built on impossible dreams, impossible idealism, born out of revolutions. And this is why myths are so important to holding it together. It is a perpetual illusion, to quote the wartime hero and the architect of the Fifth Republic, General Charles de Gaulle. And therefore, it's very easy to get lost in that romanticism while missing the real story of modern France. France is a country of high-minded principles, of liberty, equality, fraternity for all, that France fails to uphold in real life. And what my book does is cut through some of the mythologies and delusions so as to present a more rounded picture of a nation that is really struggling. And my book is precisely about the gulf between France myth on the one hand and France reality on the other hand. And they are certainly very different. The myth is a glorious republic built on the highest ideals of liberté, égalité, fraternité for all. It's the birthplace of human rights and a country where everybody is technically treated exactly the same as a valued citizen. The reality is a thoroughly uneven country where billionaire industrialists are supported by a complacent Paris establishment. All broadly support the status quo because they do very well out of it. Reform is incredibly difficult because the very dated Fifth Republic doesn't allow it. So in some ways, I argue that we're going through another Enlightenment period with better communication and far more information exposing the fault lines. So in principle, the constitution of the Fifth Republic is meant to achieve those ideals for all. In practice, however, it delivers on those ideals only for some, for those with the right background, the right education, the right gender, and the right connections. And this is the great contradiction at the heart of the French Republic that stems from its very constitution. Now, let me outline more specifically some of the fault lines that I examine in my book. My book describes how a Paris elite still benefits most from the trappings of power and indeed the riches of capitalism, while millions of citizens struggle, despite France's much vaunted egalitarian motto. So yes, one could argue that there's plenty of civil service jobs. Public spending currently represents 59% of GDP, but pay is as low as morale in this vast, unmotivated workforce. State debt exceeds 3 trillion euros, and the government ran a budget deficit of 5.5% of GDP in 2023. Now, there's a number of economists who believe that the current system is unsustainable. And that's why millions of French citizens regularly take to the streets to express their anger. There were 2 massive riot seasons last year, one to oppose plans to raise the retirement age from 62 to 64. Now, it might not sound like a particularly controversial measure, but President Emmanuel Macron pushed it through without winning a majority in Parliament using a presidential decree. And this was a prime example of how undemocratic the French political system is. The other was to express outrage at the shooting dead of an ethnic minority teenager by a policeman, an agent of the state. 17-year-old Nahel Merzouk was French, of Algerian and Moroccan background. And in that sense, the Fifth Republic's firm roots in the Algerian War still influence the way people like Nahel are treated today. Nahel's killing led to more than a week of rioting, but the really violent rioting doesn't just come from ethnic minorities. In fact, the biggest protest movement in recent years was the Gilets Jaunes, the so-called yellow vests, who are mainly working class, white agitators. They brought cities such as Paris to a standstill Saturday after Saturday, while causing millions of pounds worth of damage. These were classic French riots, institutionalized riots that have been a continual feature of Macron's both terms of office. So people from different communities, whether in rural France or indeed on neglected housing estates, do not feel a sense of fraternity, unfortunately. My book analyzes France's fault lines through multiple subjects, but perhaps the best way to illustrate this broken republic is through politics, because it's the whole presidential system that renders France broken. France's constitutional setup leads to an absurd reliance on one individual with far too much influence over every field of national life. Far too much power is centralized in the head of state, who can act like a quasi-monarch and literally hijack the entire system by ruling by decree and overriding parliament, choosing his prime minister, and appointing anyone he likes to form a government, whether close friends or indeed corporate cronies. They don't even have to be elected politicians, not even the prime minister. The president doesn't have to worry about criminal prosecution, and he can pardon cronies who get into trouble. The French president doesn't need a coalition to govern either. The head of state is also the commander-in-chief of the armed forces and has his finger on the nuclear button. In other words, this is the very definition of an elective dictatorship. It is also a structure that encourages sleaze and corruption, as shown by the criminal convictions of recent French presidents, including Nicolas Sarkozy and the late Jacques Chirac. And this undoubtedly undermines democracy. So the current Fifth Republic is in fact a makeshift measure created by General Charles de Gaulle in 1958 to impose military rule during the Algerian War of Independence. It is therefore an outdated presidential system that points to a yawning democratic deficit. And I argue that checks and balances are needed to put an end to this elective dictatorship. You know, the French have always liked powerful commanders at the top, and this certainly goes back to Napoleon Bonaparte or indeed the pre-revolutionary monarchs. And I have to say that Macron's aloofness has struck me every time I have met him. But I think the prospect of a far-right prime minister and indeed president is certainly one of the biggest crises in the Fifth Republic. Marine Le Pen of the National Rally has come runner-up to Emmanuel Macron in the last two presidential elections. He cannot stand in 3 years' time, only two terms are allowed constitutionally, and Le Pen is currently leading opinion polls as a potential successor in 2027. And meanwhile, her protégé, 28-year-old Jordan Bardella, could be propelled in a few days' time to the second top job of prime minister, if his party achieves an absolute majority in the National Assembly. Now, technically, the president could choose whom he likes, but by convention, he has to nominate the leader of the majority party in parliament. Le Pen is currently one of only 89 National Rally-linked members of parliament, which is a relatively small majority out of 577 MPs. But her power base in the National Assembly will certainly increase following these current parliamentary elections. In any case, this is by no means a prerequisite for ultimate power in France. Instead, one single determined individual can play and beat the system. So millions thought it was outrageous of Macron to push up the retirement age from 62 to 64 without a parliamentary approval. But imagine what Marine Le Pen will get up to if she's in charge. She too can rule by decree while filling up her government with unelected politicians and implement the most bigoted policies or worse. And if you look at the history, the National Rally, formerly known as the National Front, well, they are a pretty terrifying party. And as I make clear in my book, they represent a party with direct roots to the Nazis. The National Rally was founded as the National Front in 1972 by Jean-Marie Le Pen, Marine Le Pen's father, who the now convicted racist and Holocaust denier. Those who made up the original National Front Leadership Committee included men who had fought in the Waffen-SS during the Second World War and thus swore an oath to Adolf Hitler, or else served in the French paramilitary units, the militias, that collaborated with the Third Reich. Others who dominated the party were convicted secret army organization criminals, the OAS, a terrorist organization made up by army and police officers committed to see Algeria remain French. Founding members also included some who fought in Algeria, including Le Pen Senior himself. He was a paratrooper and intelligence officer in 1957, and he was involved in acts of torture in Algeria. He was a 28-year-old lieutenant, and in his own words, he described his role in Algeria as, and I quote his words, a mixture between being an SS officer and a Gestapo agent. Now, Marine Le Pen claims that she has softened and indeed diversified the party. She even tried to recruit me when I met her on a number of occasions. But I can assure you that Nazi nostalgia remains very strong amongst some of its rank and file. And so there's vicious prejudice against Arabs and Muslims, not least because of the bitter resentment over the loss of France's colonial empire in Africa and North Africa, and especially in Algeria in the 1960s. And Le Pen still regularly complains that immigrants turn France into a gigantic squat and that entire neighborhoods are taken over by foreigners. But Marine Le Pen remains very much a chip off the old bloc, Jean-Marie Le Pen. And it has to be said that Macron's policies from law and order to immigration have also become far more reactionary so as to face up to the Le Pen challenge. And you also have people like Eric Zemmour, for example, a shock jock right-winger and a convicted racist, who stood for president against Macron in 2022. And he was openly rehearsing great replacement theory, the hyperbolic and indeed deeply racist theory that white European identity is threatened by large families linked to Africa and North Africa. And there is no better illustration of how far-right discourse has become mainstream in France. But there isn't simply a problem with the far right. The entire system is riddled with discrimination and indeed prejudice. And by far, the ugliest form of discrimination in French society is still one built on race. Whole ethnic minority communities live on out-of-town estates that former socialist prime minister Manuel Valls said contributed, and again, these are his words, to a social, ethnic, and territorial apartheid in France. Now, Valls pledged to provide what he called Republican answers rather than practically tackling discrimination. But racist sentiment is extremely hard to monitor or indeed regulate in France because the so-called colorblind republic doesn't compile data on the subject, which is dangerously counterproductive in a nation built on immigration and where it is estimated that 32% of people under 60 have migrant ancestry. Now, with such statistics banned, France's lofty universalism aims to secure social unity precisely by ignoring differences. Now, again, there's a great contradiction between fantasy equality and real-world discrimination, and that is startling because real discrimination does exist because, as it turns out, your race and indeed your religion actually do matter in France when it comes to being discriminated against. There are unofficial sociological surveys that have found that 91% of black people are the victims of racism, while minority groups in general are woefully underrepresented in politics, the media, and other key industries. Minority groups are also four times more likely to be stopped and searched. Compulsory identity checks are in fact a colonial law and order tool that is still prevalent today. And the so-called colorblind egalitarianism is in fact another pipe dream. It ignores very real forms of discrimination, racial and religious. And if you do not have official data about a problem, then it will remain conveniently ignored so as to preserve the status quo. So in this sense, the Gallic culture, which is envied all over the world, is not designed for people like me. There is a real sense of exclusion, one that is encapsulated by the out-of-town estates in the suburbs, the banlieue, where I grew up myself. And there are very few opportunities to break out of those neglected housing estates, either physically or, dare I say, metaphorically. I myself had to move abroad to improve my life chances. And as far as education is concerned, yes, there is elitism everywhere, and the class system undoubtedly still persists in countries such as Britain. But as someone who has studied and indeed worked here in the UK, and as a foreigner, I can vouch that there is far more egalitarianism over here than in France. And one only has to not take my word for it, but look at how diverse the higher echelons of societies are in Britain. And indeed, you know, Scotland had until recently a prime minister from an Asian background, for example. And so did, Sunak is on his way out now. But other ethnic minority ministers are also hold the highest offices of the state. And that is commonplace rather than an exception. Wales also has delivered its first black first minister. In fact, academic performance is more strongly linked to social background in France than in any other OECD country, which stands for Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. And despite the Republican motto, disparities prevail. And I argue that there's this gold standard conformity in France. Some 99% of candidates for the French baccalaureate, the equivalent of A-levels in the UK, the main qualification for university education, pass. 99% of candidates pass. So this statistic might sound egalitarian enough, but in fact it renders entry to a first degree course a formality rather than an achievement. And public universities, for example, for which only a modest fee is required, are like super social engineering farms. Thousands graduate with often worthless first degrees, and only a favored class gets to the top through elite public institutions, mostly funded by the state because they are from the right background. Now, again, this is a blatant contradiction of France's supposedly egalitarian ideology. A consistent way France clampdowns on minorities is banning Muslim women from wearing any type of so-called Muslim dress. Headscarves, for example, are said to break strict laws concerned with the separation of church and state, and so athletes covering their heads will not be allowed to represent France at the Olympic Games this summer, for example. The great contradiction in French feminist discourse, whether it's argued by the left or indeed the right, is that it uses secularism as a tool to allegedly protect and emancipate Muslim women from supposedly repressive males, while also stigmatizing and criminalizing those same women using fines and the threat of prison to enforce its diktats. Now, there are plenty of perfectly liberated French Muslims who choose to wear headscarves and Muslim clothing, yet they are branded as victims of an oppressive culture and indeed religion. And so Francis excludes and criminalizes female citizens from public spaces because of their clothes. And I argue that in this sense, France's obsession with its own brand of secularism, and indeed its often absurd form of feminism, oppresses a huge section of the population. And this weaponization of laïcité, the French form of secularism, certainly belies the country's alleged belief in egalitarianism. But it's not just Muslim women who are being oppressed. France is profoundly misogynistic. The 2023 annual report by the French government's principal equality watchdog revealed that the country, and this is a quote from the report, remains very sexist in all its spheres. And there were calls for what they called an emergency plan to combat growing and often lethal violence against women. So from power players in politics to men in the streets, this sexism crisis really is showing no sign of abating in France. A few concluding remarks, if I may. The French are not just unhappy about single issues. Many of them, in fact, rage against the entire system. And that, too, is what my book is about. A country literally built on revolution, and where the turmoil never subsides, because there is, in fact, widespread inequality, clampdowns on freedom and social division that really move us away from any sense of fraternity. And the reality is that France's lost grandeur also manifests itself domestically in ancient institutions that are no longer fit for purpose. There is corruption, strife, and industrial decay. And there's also the very real prospect of a far-right president taking over all power. And this sense of downgrading, of déclassement, is also reflected in foreign policy. Just look at the way former African colonies such as Niger and Burkina Faso have been rejecting lingering French influence and indeed exploitation in recent months and years. Populations there are sick and tired of the French keeping military bases while maintaining financial control over their former colonies through Paris, and indeed control over those former colonies' resources. They want to be left to run their own affairs. Now, if this all sounds unnecessarily gloomy, I can assure you that fixing France is by no means a long series of complaints or indeed a misery memoir. It is not a political manifesto either, but a straightforward read about a modern republic that is failing to live up to its once exalted reputation, while I also draw on political, historical, and cultural factors, as well as my own personal experience. And I would argue that the book is ultimately a call for change. And in this sense, it's very optimistic. It's a disruptive book, but in a positive way. It follows the great French tradition of dissenting progress. And I've tried to make my book as honest as possible and write it in a way that will appeal to anybody, whatever their background. So I very much that you will give Fixing France a chance and that you'll enjoy reading it.
Nabila, thank you so much. That was a tour de force. And so I want to try and marry up some of the sort of diagnoses with what's happening right now. And so you very eloquently lay out the problems of this republic and the constitution, which gives the executive almost untrammeled power. It's basically sort of a quasi-monarchical role that the president holds. So in light of that, the fact that we're having elections for the National Assembly, so the parliament, which in this constitutional arrangement is almost, can be easily overlooked. Why should we be worried if Marine Le Pen and her party have a majority in a National Assembly, which in this constitution has been massively deprioritized? I mean, isn't it the case that whatever happens tomorrow, Macron is still in charge of France?
Well, very much so. I mean, that's the irony in this deeply flawed presidential system, which grants, power, all powers to one single individual. And the presidential system is overwhelming in France to the extent that, it doesn't really matter what the National Assembly looks like, because ultimately it's the president who remains in charge. And the myth is that the new prime minister chooses a new government, but actually the president, who is by far the most powerful figure in the Fifth Republic, chooses a new government, not least of all because he chooses the prime minister. Macron has regularly hired and fired prime ministers. Some of them haven't even been politicians, let alone elected ones. Himself, he was a civil servant when he acted as finance minister for François Hollande, the former socialist president. But I would say that a national rally, for example, prime minister, would undoubtedly have more power to construct the government if the party gets an absolute majority in the National Assembly. By convention, the president will have to allow a majority party in the National Assembly to form a government. And again, the caveat is a control freak like Macron wouldn't nonetheless let them or let the prime minister do everything, not at all. And in fact, if he doesn't like the makeup of the new parliament, he can dissolve it. Mm-hmm. If he doesn't get on with the new government or indeed with the new National Assembly, he can ignore it and bypass it and continue to rule by decree. But what it testifies to, it's the abject failure of the presidential system, and which will undoubtedly lead to more instability, because that would mean that we will have very short-lived governments, lots of infighting, not just in the National Assembly, but on the streets, a lot more chaos, which will reveal a divided France more than ever. And that's why I forcefully make the point that we need to move from this makeshift republic, which literally emerged from the Algerian War to try to keep the Algerian nationalists in check, which was meant to be temporary. France was threatened with civil war. It was meant to last 5 years or less. But more than 65 years on, we still have the same setup with effectively a strong man in charge of everything. Now, I think it's concerning enough when we have a centrist, so-called centrist, liberal, progressive politician like Emmanuel Macron in charge. But it is a lot more terrifying if we have the likes of Marine Le Pen in charge of the country. And there is no doubt that she already feels that the country is effectively vindicating her view of the world, her view for France, and calling the snap election on the back of a very successful EU parliamentary elections has boosted the far right enormously. The National Rally had 6 seats in the National Assembly before the 2017 presidential election, ended up with 89 seats at the legislative elections that followed that presidential election. And now they could end up with, the projections are between 200 and 250 seats, a bit short of an absolute majority, but who knows? It depends on the turnout was absolutely massive in the first round, almost 70%. And I imagine that it will be a lot higher in the second round, given the stakes. So it will give her an enormous amount of credibility, not least of all, because, as I said, I think Macron himself has contributed to make far-right policies mainstream himself.
I mean, and you're very categorical. At the end of the book, you say the Fifth Republic is dead. Vive la Nouvelle République. But isn't there now a massive danger that if you open up this constitutional Pandora's box, talking about a Sixth Republic, that because the far right are in the ascendancy, that they get to drive the conversation about what a new constitutional arrangement looks like. And so everything you've laid out is for one, for more democracy and a stronger parliament. But that's not necessarily where we could end up. We could end up paradoxically with a more authoritarian system, because the winds of change in France seem to be pushing towards authoritarianism rather than sort of a more democratized parliamentary system, the one that you're advocating for.
Well, first of all, it's important to highlight that France has moved from one iteration of the Republic to the next, always because there was a crisis. For example, the Third Republic was in crisis because of the Franco-Prussian War, and that's led to its end, bringing in the Fourth Republic, which was massively unstable. I think there were 21 administrations in its 12 years, and it was particularly unstable due to the Algerian War. So that brought in the Fifth Republic. And I actually argued that Marine Le Pen, at the gates of power, as the outgoing prime minister himself, Gabriel Attal, has put it, could be this shock that could lead to the Sixth Republic. Now, could they be in charge? Could they be in charge of the constitution? That remains to be seen. There's a lot of caveats in what the National Rally is proposing. And as we've seen with the immigration bill that they pushed through last January, thanks to the cooperation with Emmanuel Macron, in fact, we've seen the Constitutional Council, the highest jurisdiction in the judiciary in France, clamp down on those measures. For example, its most reactionary clauses were struck out by the judiciary. And in actual fact, when you look at the National Rally's measures, or we can't call them yet policies, but a lot of them, most of them, if not all of them, are in fact anti-constitutional, from the economics proposals to their more social policy proposals. For example, their idea of lowering the VAT from 20% to 5% is unconstitutional. The way they want to call a budget is unconstitutional. They've come up with proposals, as far as their social policies are concerned, revoking the Republican right to become automatically French if you're born on French soil, including to foreign parents. That has been deemed unconstitutional. They want to, for example, bar dual nationals from holding public sector jobs. That also has been deemed unconstitutional. So has been the proposal to ban the headscarf in all public spheres, including on the streets. So I don't think they can be as in charge as they think they would be.
And to change that constitution, they would need 2/3 majority, which even in a very successful outcome tomorrow would be unlikely.
Well, it would be more likely to change the constitution if Marine Le Pen ends up as president of France, because the president can change the constitution. And the most terrifying aspect is you can win two rounds in a straightforward presidential vote to end up with all powers, just as Emmanuel Macron did himself. If you recall, he was never a member of any political party. He was never an elected politician. He didn't even have a political formation, a political party behind him. He created a vehicle called En Marche. The initials are EM, conveniently, also for Emmanuel Macron, so very much a one-man band. And he managed to play and beat the system. He took advantage of political landscape at the time, where the conservative Gaullists were imploding because of a number of corruption scandals, which saw the criminalization of Nicolas Sarkozy, but also François Fillon, and then the late Jacques Chirac. So all that sleaze and corruption led to the party imploding, and a very inefficient socialist party, which also collapsed. So in that political landscape, he was very, very lucky to end up becoming president of France.
I think it's worth remembering that probably even less than a year ago, British politicians, like I think both Rishi Sunak and and Keir Starmer used Macron as a bit of a lodestar and their model for this sort of new type of centrism. And actually, he's not a model for those types of centrists now. He's actually a model for the far right because they see the way that he's been able to exercise extreme and untrammeled power. And just before we get to questions, I was in Paris last week for the first round of the elections. And when I'm sort of in a country going through elections, I love just turning on the news and seeing how the media cover it. And I was very surprised, and I was also there in 2017 and before, that the far right are covered by the media as just another party. Actually, a lot of the discussions I was watching on mainstream French TV were actually about whether this party is actually of the far right, and maybe far right is a stigmatizing term and we shouldn't use it. It seems like to me that we've entered a world where so-called mainstream parties are actively part of the normalization of the far right, and they present it as something like a victimless crime almost. That, oh, this would be terrible because it means our parties are not in power, but they don't really talk about the real world consequences, the hostile environments that can be created for minorities in France. I mean, tell us about what could be, you know, who are the people at the sharpest end of this potential huge, you know, crossing the Rubicon moment that could happen tomorrow.
But that's an extremely important point that you bring up, because there's a tendency, especially in the British media, to present also the far right as a mainstream party. You know, I was even reading on the, well, let's name them, the BBC website, that Jean-Marie Le Pen was a patriot. There was no mention of him being a convicted racist or indeed an anti-Semite and Holocaust denier. No mention of the party's firm roots in Nazism, that they all bear this legacy, including the colonial, the savage colonial legacy as a badge of honor. All this context seems irrelevant. In actual fact, the tag far right is absolutely apt and perfectly relevant to describe the National Rally, and indeed in its previous form, the National Front, not just because of their reactionary, not to say racist policies. For example, the catchphrase is national preference, which is a euphemism for out and out discriminatory and indeed xenophobic policies. In fact, the National Rally has been classed as far right by the French Interior Ministry itself. So, and Marine Le Pen has gone to court a number of times to try to lose that tag, and she lost every single time because French courts ruled that the policies put forward, the discriminatory policies put forward by the party, were deemed far right, anti-constitutional, and indeed the courts allowed her party to be labeled as fascist, a fascist party. So there's no doubt about, you know, about that whatsoever. And I think there was a tendency in Britain, especially in the wake of Brexit, to make Marine Le Pen a lot more respectable, because she would vindicate the British choice of exiting the EU, because at the time she was calling for a Frexit herself. Now she's changed her view. It has to be said that the National Rally changed her view at a drop of a hat. She realizes now that France, being a founding father of the EU, of the entire project, they cannot just exit so easily. And of course, there's a lot of her constituency that benefit from EU money. And if you want to be seen as a credible, viable politician, you cannot just dump the whole project at the doors of the Germans. So that's a very important aspect to highlight, that yes, it is definitely a far-right party.
Thank you. We will open it up to the floor, and I think we will group questions together. We've got a lady over there, the gentleman in the cap, and the gentleman all the way at the back, and then I'll come around to do a second round.
Could you just explain the French voting system? Because that presumably has a bearing on how likely the National Rally is to be elected.
Thank you. And then the gentleman in the cap here.
Hello. Thank you for the talk. It was exquisite. I'm just thinking about the election here, and particularly about reform, looking at what's happening in France. And just to encapsulate it a little bit, I currently work in a warehouse. I was previously a teacher. One thing I'd never mentioned my teaching qualifications because of the discrimination I would take from the workers. But I just don't know how to cut across with reform, because no matter what I try to argue or point out, it's this anti-intellectualism thing that you just, even my boss calls me the global elite, and I say I'm just a cleaner. But it is worrying, and I'm very, very worried if Labour don't get a grip on things. God forbid we end up like France. I'm quite pessimistic. Thank you.
That's a very good point. And then we'll go right back up to the top with the gentleman with the glasses on.
Just to say, ask you a little bit more about the impact of Islamophobia. By some accounts, France is probably the most most important Islamophobic country in the European Union, because it actually mainstreams Islamophobia in a way that places like China, India, Tel Aviv can't do. So it's seen as something, as a liberal, established liberal democratic study. If it bans anti-racist, anti-Islamicist groups, then anyone, or anti-Islamophobia groups, anyone can do that anywhere in the world. So I was just wondering to what extent it's not the danger of the far right winning the election, but it's the actual mainstreaming. And even if they don't win an overall majority, they're shifting the discourse. And whether you see there's any kind of attempt to change the discourse, public discourse around the far right and their values around Islamophobia, rather than simply just looking for electoral victories or electoral advantage.
Lovely, thank you. Okay, so we'll start with this question about how the voting system, I guess, for this round of elections, for the parliamentary elections, how it works.
Yes, absolutely. That's a very pertinent question, because the French voting system is extremely complicated. But as far as the French parliamentary elections are concerned, whoever gets more than 12.5% of the vote in the first right goes through to the second round. And then you end up with a situation where it's referred to as triangular constituencies, where you have three candidates who will be competing in the second round. And the New Popular Front, which is a coalition of leftist groupings encapsulating the Greens, the Communists, the Socialists, France Unbowed, and lots of minor leftist groups, have for the first time in decades got their act together and united to keep the far right out of power and out of government. They've rebranded themselves the Popular Front after the second round, with the explicit aim of forming alliances, tactical alliances, and there's been a lot of horse trading going on, to try to keep the far right out. That was the explicit aim. And the party, or the coalition of the President Emmanuel Macron, Renaissance, or Together, as it's a very floating party, it has to be said, has agreed after the first round to make a deal with this Popular Front, including the leftist, the extreme left of the Popular Front, to try to keep the far right out. That wasn't the case previously. They see the extreme left as ideological enemies, and they didn't particularly want to deal with them. That has changed after the first round, given the enormous vote share that went to the National Rally. Now, there's a distinction between vote share and seat share. The crucial point is how it will translate into seat shares. And
we have that problem.
So ever since the first round, that's the kind of dealings that have been going on. And the idea is you keep in place between the Popular Front and the presidential coalition the candidate that's most likely to beat the National Rally candidate, so as to secure a seat in parliament and, more crucially, to keep the far right out of the National Assembly. Now, it has worked in general, but there's been plenty of mavericks, including in the presidential grouping, saying, well, you might say that, but I'll stay put, meaning that there's a risk of letting the far right win that constituency just out of sheer, personal interest, I guess. So on the far left, and indeed the leftist coalition, they have been more disciplined about it. They were more keen to give way to anybody but the far right. For example, in the constituency where the former Prime Minister Elizabeth Borne is running, the Popular Front, the leftist Popular Front groupings is allowing her to get a clear run against the National Rally. In Macron's constituency in Amiens, they're allowing the leftist candidate to remain in the race so as to beat the National Rally. So that's how it works. It's complicated, but how it works. It's to achieve two things: to keep the far right out of power and to avoid a very unworkable situation where you'll have what is called the cohabitation. In case the National Rally achieves an absolute majority, then basically President Emmanuel Macron will have to work with his ideological enemy and will be in a situation where we will be governing with a prime minister from the political groupings that he hates. So that would be undesirable. It wouldn't get anything done. We've had a cohabitation in 1997, for example, the most recent one, when Chirac called the snap parliamentary elections, hoping to get a majority to pass through his conservative economic policies, and he ended up with a socialist government. So that's the, you know, the in simple terms, the how the French system works.
And I think the magic number is 289, that's the threshold.
The absolute majority, 289 out of 577 seats, absolute.
And then we have the second question, which I think is very pertinent and I'm also worried about, which is, I think, the very technocratic instincts of the current new landslide Labour majority government. If you look at countries around the world, it's usually the technocratic centrists that are the interregnum period before something really scary happens. And we saw that probably with Obama for two terms. Maybe in France, you could say it actually started with François Hollande, you know, Mr. Boring, who suddenly paved the way for people who were political innovators to come and take the space. Is there a danger that Labour actually acts as that interregnum in the UK?
Well,
ahead of reform and or maybe a merged Tory reform party?
There is certainly a risk of the... It's not just a risk, it's already translated in the EU Parliament votes of the extremists getting more popularity in the polls because they feel that they're being let down by those so-called centrist and moderate governments who only deliver for the super rich. I mean, the one tag that Macron is often associated with is he's called the president of the rich because he looks after an elite, after his multi-billionaire national industrialists, and there's a massive constituency of people who are left behind and who do not feel that the wealth is trickling down in a massively rich country, it has to be said. But I would say that the problems of extremism in France are specific to France in the sense that, yes, there is extremism on the rise everywhere, but I think other countries are far better equipped to keep the extremists in check. For example, yes, Farage has managed to secure a seat after eight times, I think. But, you know, you don't have a scenario where you have 89 far-right MPs in the House of Commons, or, as it looks likely, more than 200, as will happen in France, more likely. So I think even countries like Germany, they have learned to work with coalitions. They were certainly very keen to reform the image of the country, especially moving away from the horrors of the Second World War to a modern, liberal, welcoming democracy. But France is not equipped. It doesn't have the democratic mechanisms to keep those extremists out, quite the opposite. And that's why you end up with a scenario of somebody like Éric Zemmour, who's been convicted five times for inciting racial and religious hatred, to be able to stand for the top job, literally. That wouldn't happen in the UK. You know, if there's a hint of somebody being racist, they have to step down, let alone if they are criminalized, if they have been criminalized for such offenses. I mean, one thing that became very obvious during this campaigning in France is that you look at every single candidate of the national rally, and they all have very nasty antecedents. One had to step down because she was embarrassed about a picture of her emerging wearing a Waffen-SS cap, literally. Another one is saying, well, you know, I'm not a racist. My optician is Jewish. My dentist is Muslim. I'm not a racist. And another one came up saying, you know, well, you know, we've organized a biker's race and the priest who, you know, what's the word, who ordained or the convention is a black man. I didn't, you know, run him over. I didn't run him over. I'm not a racist, blatantly. I mean, it's just absolutely mad. And again, Britain is not underpinned, or the Reform Party is not steeped in fascism. It's not steeped in a very sinister colonial history. So there's a gulf there. And there's something very specific about France's xenophobic climate. And you see it in, for example, the banlieue. There's even a term to describe people who are stuck on the margins and excluded from society. You see it in the political discourse, which again has become mainstream, referring to troublemakers, especially if they're from an ethnic and religious minority background, as savages. Literally, these are words that are used on French television, in French, in print, or, you know, on the radio, and by the political class. They talk about ensauvagement, turning savage, literally. And you also have the influence of media moguls, as somebody called Vincent Bolloré, for example, who's referred to as a Francis Rupert Murdoch, who pours lots of millions into mainstream channels to get the kind of shock jocks that will preach extremism, such as Eric Zemmour. He used to turn up on TV, radio, and stations consistently, even putting his most offensive comments on those very platforms, which led to his criminalization. So I think there's a gulf into how institutionalized racism actually is in France.
And maybe on that we can also get to the potency of Islamophobia as well.
Precisely. You quite rightly say that it's absolutely mainstream. And what is more shocking is that in the country of Voltaire and Rousseau and the Enlightenment and all that, we end up with this kind of extremist discourse where you get politicians who put an anti in front of every policy statement, anti-Islam, anti-Europe, anti-immigration, anti-globalization, and so forth and so on. Because there's a real fear that French traditional lifestyles would disappear. And that's why parties such as the National Rally focus on keeping France as it was, as a glorious, basically living off a glorious mythical past. And that leads to discourse such as, you know, we must drive French cars, produce French farming products, and, you know, basically have a very narrow-minded provincial mindset and ignore the realities of how the real global world actually works.
Do we have any more questions? We are running out of time. I saw somebody's hand. We are at 12 o'clock. Okay, I've been told off. But hopefully Nabila will be outside signing her book, so you can, anyone who wants to chat, didn't get a chance to, can see her outside. So my last task is to say thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Explore Words, Discover Worlds podcast, presented by Bradford Literature Festival. If you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to help support the podcast, please subscribe, share this episode with others and leave a rating. Mark your calendars for the return of Bradford Literature Festival on Friday the 27th of June to Sunday the 6th of July 2025.